Time to take a look at home renovation and repair issues. We'll also, of course, look at energy efficiency. That's all part of it, I guess, as we visit with our two guests today. Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison. It's a full-service residential remodeling company that Chad owns. It specializes in sustainable design, historic renovations, that sort of thing. John Viner is a senior project director with educational programs at the Energy Center of Wisconsin. And, of course, he focuses a lot on energy and energy savings kinds of issues when it comes to your home. So I hope you'll join in. If you have a question, give us a call. The number 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. And Chad, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
And John, great to see you again, too.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Always fun.
We have an email already from Christy who asking about asphalt shingling and wondering which shingles have the longest life, and sort of also asked, does a black shingle make an attic hotter than a light-colored shingle might?
Well, those are good questions. Asphalt shingles tend to have a actual lifespan of anywhere from, say, 15 to perhaps 30 years at the high end. And they're rated often 20 to perhaps 50 years. But really, the rating has to do with how thick the shingle is, because it's going to take a beating in the weather, and a thinner shingle is not going to last as long. The color of the shingle is definitely a very real contributor to how much heat gain you're going to get in an attic. And we generally recommend a light-colored shingle so that you reflect the light. If you put a dark shingle on, you're going to absorb that heat, and you're going to make for a really hot attic, and it's going to heat up that structure. And we generally are not looking to have that sort of a heat gain with our homes, because our insulation is behind that, and you know, we're trying to keep that heat out.
Yeah. So. Okay. So it wouldn't make a difference in the wintertime. Somebody said, well, what about wintertime? We'll get a little more heat in the house if there's black shingles.
Well, right. I mean, if it's a properly insulated and air sealed home, then you're really not going to be taking advantage of that heat gain. So.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Eric in Madison has a question, so let's go to Eric. Hi, Eric. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I have blown away insulation in my attic, and there's a few lowish spots, and I have some fiberglass bats left over from another project. Can I lay those down over that?
Well, you could do that, though I want to point out an opportunity that you might have. Generally, the most important thing that you need to do when you're insulating or re-insulating an attic is to make sure that the various places that wiring and pipes penetrate interior walls into the attic are properly air sealed. It's also likely that around a chimney or at some other interior wall, there is a chase that at one time was there by design to allow for wiring and pipes to go from the basement all the way up to the attic. While this is practical if you're remodeling your home, it's very important that once the remodeling is done or the building is completed, that that chase be sealed up at the top, which is where the lid of your insulated box is. And so that's something we often find when we remodel a home and do a home performance evaluation. We find there's a big hole up in the attic next to a chimney or somewhere else, and a lot of air, hot air in the summer or cold air in the winter, is flowing down into the home through that chase. So it's important that you air seal. Once that air sealing is done, you could use that fiberglass insulation. Frankly, I think you're better off just getting some bags of loose fill and topping off the loose fill in the attic. You're talking about some relatively inexpensive material. And one problem with the batting is that air will be able to flow all around it. You're kind of putting in these kind of pieces of material, but you won't have a good way to create a complete and continuous blanket of insulation with that bat insulation. So That would be my recommendation.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Chris emailed, wonders if you can put a metal roof on directly over a shingled roof of a simple ranch home.
Well, it is possible if there's only one layer of shingles on the home. That would be, the critical question because the metal roof is relatively light, and we have to be concerned about weight loads on a roof. So typically a house is designed for a maximum of two layers of shingles. So that should not be a problem if it's only one layer. And then you have the added benefit of if the roof is not currently failing, you have that additional layer should sure. water make its way past the metal roof.
All right. On to Patty in Middleton next. Patty, hi to you.
I'm doing great. Thank you. How are you?
Just fine. And what can we do for you today?
Well, we have a greenhouse attached to our home, and it is leaking. It has been leaking for some time, and the wood is rotted. I went up and caulked it, and then it still leaked a little bit. I went and caulked it again with silicone, and now it seems to not be leaking. I'm kind of concerned about the future, and who would we call to have somebody take a look at it, maybe give an estimate? We don't know who to call. It seems beyond our handyman because he's caulked it before and it didn't seem to work.
Patty, what is the greenhouse made out of? Is it a metal structure or is it a wood structure?
Wood.
Well, you could probably talk to about any qualified remodeling contractor. I would just encourage you to make some phone calls, perhaps using the NARI directory, just ask if individuals are interested in looking at a project like that. For a wood structure, I think many builders would be able to help you. If it's a metal structure, then you're into more of a specialty that I know I, for one, would not be able to help you out with a metal structure, really. But
I see. Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much for calling. And you can join in, too, with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Before we take another call, John, what have you been up to at the Energy Center of Wisconsin? What are some things going on over there?
Well, we've got several training opportunities for contractors and for homeowners underway. We certainly specialize in residential training opportunities and commercial. But on the home side, we have one in December called Windows and Walls, What Makes Them Tick. It's going to be in Madison as well as La Crosse.
Okay.
That'll be December 10th and 11th.
Okay.
There is going to be one on roofing. Mm-hmm. So that may be of interest. We've been talking about roofs a little bit today. So that'll be probably January 20th and 21st, Milwaukee in the Madison area. And you can find these training opportunities at the Energy Center of Wisconsin website. That's ecw.org. But one of the bigger conferences that we host every year is the Better Buildings, Better Business Conference in Wisconsin Dells. So that's one that the crew is certainly working hard at to pull in a couple of 2 to 3 dozen presenters locally, local presenters and national presenters, and have a couple good 2 days up at the Kalahari Resort in Wisconsin Dells, really with an emphasis on new home construction and remodeling. So there's sessions for the contractor as well as for the homeowner that I think they would get a lot out of.
The Wisconsin Dells event, when is that?
That's March 3rd to the 5th. So it's a two-day conference, very well attended. It's really a nice homegrown energy efficiency building construction workshop that the Energy Center of Wisconsin has put together. I believe this is probably the 8th annual.
Okay, and just go to ecw.org to find out about any of those events that are coming
right, up. Right, ecw.org, and then look at the Energy Center University tab at the top.
All right. Let's turn to Lauren in Eau Claire next. Lauren, hi to you. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We are doing some home renovation in the back of the house. We have a walkout basement, and a patio back there, and we have a very, very pretty panoramic view back there, and I would like to take advantage, as much advantage as I can of that. And to that end, what I was looking at was, rather than going with a residential-style window on there, I'd seen some pictures like West Coast houses and places out west where they would have these like floor-to-ceiling windows, and they almost look like kind of the commercial window that you see in a storefront. And I'm thinking about going with about maybe 15 feet wide of that style of window, and they cost quite a bit less than residential windows do. And I'm just wondering, am I going to, you know, what is the big drawback? I mean, I realize we're a little bit colder than they are out in California or out west, but what is the big drawback to using this commercial style window, if you will, and going with a wide look down there?
Well, we certainly are going to have to take a look at the characteristics of the window. So the U-value of the window is one of the primary ones.
Okay.
And the solar heat gain coefficient. So it may be, I'm not very familiar with the commercial windows and what their standard characteristics are. But in Wisconsin, we'd like to have a U-value below 0.35. If you had a U-value of 0.30 or 0.29, that's a pretty high quality window. If we see that that U value is say 0.45 or 0.4, that's, we would prefer a little better quality window to reduce the heat loss into the home. What direction does that side of the house face?
It faces, the back of the house faces probably south by, or east, I'm sorry, west by southwest.
West by southwest, so is it? It's pretty sunny then, it sounds like, right there?
Fairly sunny, yes.
So we're going to, a window with a high solar heat gain coefficient, the higher the number, the more the heat gain when that sun shines on that window. So
okay,
we do have to be cautious so we don't overheat that space, even in the wintertime, as well as in the summertime. So maybe a lower solar heat gain coefficient, unless we're incorporating some passive solar design where we have a little bit of thermal mass down there where we can absorb that heat without overheating the space. That's where it takes a little bit of engineering to understand that window surface area to the amount of thermal storage that we may have, whether it's the concrete floor or other designed type of mass within that home. I think
okay,
commercial windows probably are going to have an aluminum or a metal frame around them. Often
yes,
I'll see that. So
Condensation,
that metal frame along the edges, that's going to get cold, and we can get condensation in that on that surface of the glass, and you're going to be taking a rag and having to mop up in the wintertime, potentially. These are all just potentials that could take place if we put in a window that isn't designed to be efficient, especially in a cold climate like Wisconsin. We really have to put our emphasis on quality windows to keep that glass surface and the edges around the glass warm, just so we don't have to start getting water staining and dripping on the floor, etc.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Well, it sounds to me like the energy rating, I think they have these windows, they have E windows, which I think is kind of are low E windows where there's not quite as much heat or cold transfer. And from what I hear you saying, I should be looking for some kind of a coefficient that would bring me into, you know, the realm of something normal, something that would be acceptable.
Yep.
You say it should be lower than what? What number now? I'm sorry.
An Energy Star window would be 0.35 or less. So
okay,
0.3, 0.35 or less. And whether commercial windows have, some are rated, some you may not have a little difficulty finding that, but we certainly would prefer to have one that is rated and know what it is. And regardless, with the aluminum edges or the spacers in that window, it's going to be hard to get a big window down that low is what I would suspect.
Okay. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Lauren. Chad Spade and John Viner, our guests here as we talk energy efficiency, home renovation, and repair issues. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join in today, have a question about making your home a little more energy efficient, or maybe you're into renovating and or repairing, certainly join us at 800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. And Bozina in Madison, thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. It's all very interesting, so I'm sitting here taking notes. I have a question about roof.
Okay.
We had to redo our roof last year due to ice backing. The roof was 9 years old. And as the shingles were taken off, the contractor said that all the plywood is delaminated, and he would basically have to take it all off. But he proposed that he will just cover it with the OSB, although in my estimate I had the replacement of a plywood into plywood. And he would just cover it. This will give me better insulation and more sturdy roof, what he did. And as I'm looking right now in all these things, it wasn't right. I mean, I paid for the plywood being exchanged, and it wasn't, and the plywood was not used. And I found out right now that would he take the old plywood, he could improve the ventilation of the roof. It's a 40-year-old house, so there is not really a lot of ventilation on the slopy part of the roof.
So your question is,
what should I do now?
Okay. So what prompted hiring a contractor to come out was ice dams in the first place, correct?
Yes, yes.
And the roof was 9 years old, and that's the age of the house.
No, the age of the house is 40 years old.
This
was our roof. We put the roof 9 years ago, so I don't know. I assume it was the second roof.
Yeah, so putting OSB over the top of the old roof sheathing, probably typically the delaminated roof sheathing is removed and new is replaced rather than put over the top, and maybe Chad can speak to whether he's seen it otherwise, but generally we're going to just replace that poor roof sheathing so we don't add the added weight to that roof system. So ideally you'd only have one layer of roof sheathing and then your shingles. Often when it comes to solving ice dams, it is misunderstood, and we contractors will generally move quickly to attic ventilation and ventilating that space before addressing the heat loss from the house into that attic space. So not only does insulation work to reduce heat loss into that space, it's air sealing and plugging the holes. So it having access to that attic areas, ensuring that the attic is sealed well, which means there's no airflow from the house into the attic, and then insulated properly. And then third, we would move to attic ventilation, ensure that we have it all in place.
Can I add something? This is not the way it was built, so the insulation is just below the plywood, leaving a space of 3 inches from the plywood to insulation.
And that's fine. Right now, the insulation is space, and there's a separation of a couple inches from the insulation to the underside of that roof sheathing. That's fine as long as we have holes within our soffit, or we have soffit venting, so the attic has a free flow of air from low on the roof at the soffits to someplace high on that roof system. And we didn't address necessarily any air leakage, where if there's a bathroom near that, there's often a lot of plumbing penetrations and holes that should have been addressed, but it isn't often in the contract, and not necessarily the contractor's responsibility if it isn't spelled out to do so. That's where the state's Focus on Energy program and Home Performance with Energy Star has a contingency of well-trained building performance consultants that often work alongside building contractors to help provide that guidance and work scope to get a complete package.
Chad, anything to add to that?
Well, I guess I would agree with John that if you have delaminating plywood, it is important to probably replace it outright. It's not unheard of to put a new layer of sheeting down over an existing layer. In fact, it is quite common on really old homes that have old cedar shake roofing that have gaps in between the boards. We'll typically add a half inch of plywood over top of the old sheeting. But we do have to be concerned if the plywood that was delaminating was already a second layer, we wouldn't want to add a third layer.
Right.
Just similar to what we said earlier about roofing. The delamination is often a cause of moisture from within the house as well as moisture from a leaking roof. And so it is important, as John said, to make sure that you don't have a really leaky home combined with a poorly vented roof, because that could be a problem that will come back and cause your current roof to fail again if that's not addressed. So
if you have a disagreement or an argument with somebody about the work that was performed, what's the best way for a homeowner to proceed on that? Right back first to the person who did the work, I would assume.
Yeah, for I believe the last 3 years, we have a right to cure law in Wisconsin. And so if the contractor notified you at the time of the contract of his or her right to cure, that means essentially that if there is a problem with the work, there is a process that the state has set up whereby you contact the contractor. If they are responsive, they have a right to fix the problem. And if you're not satisfied with that fix, then, you know, there's a process you go through. Barring that, and if the contractor is not responsive, then you could talk to the Better Business Bureau, or you could talk to, I believe it's the Department of Agriculture and
Trade and Consumer Protection.
Trade and Consumer Protection, right. So there are some avenues to go through, hopefully short of having to contact an attorney, but that, of course, is the... Yeah.
Chad, is there advantages by hiring a NARI contractor for disputes? Is there a process, say, if they belong to such an organization?
Well, there, yes and no. I mean, certainly I would say, being a NARI member and someone who has been on the board, I would, from my own kind of... perspective, I would say absolutely there's an advantage to that, but truth in advertising, here I
sure
am a member of the association. We do have a code of ethics, and so that is a very important advantage to working with a NARI contractor in remodeling. The consumer can file a complaint if there's a problem with the local chapter, and then there's a process that we go through. We do have an ethics committee in each chapter. And so it is possible to follow that path. And we have had members who have been basically thrown out of the mm-hmm. association because of their failure to follow ethical business practices. So that's an added protection. It's important, basically, to deal with contractors that are legitimate and established. There have been problems in recent years, particularly with all the hailstorms that happened the last couple of years.
Yeah.
We had a lot of contractors come up from other states and engage in unethical practices, talking people into roof replacements they didn't need, or doing the work in a non a professional manner, or just leaving town with large sums of money and not doing the work. So there's been all sorts of fraud. But then, you know, it's a little bit harder to deal with the issue of, well, has this work been done as it should have been done? You know, that's more of a gray area. But it is possible. It sounds like you may have some, you know, home performance related issues, and that's an opportunity for you to lower your heating bill. So I would say, you know, one way to get a professional assessment of your roof and the issues that cause the ice damming would be to consider hiring a home performance evaluator and get some good feedback on what needs to be done. And then perhaps you can find a professional that will help you resolve those problems.
Okay. And to find such a person, John, where do we go for that?
That would be focusonenergy.com.
Focusonenergy.com. Good luck, Bozina. We appreciate your call and hope that things work out for you. Thank you very much for calling. Marcus in Green Bay, we're on to you now. Hi, Marcus.
Oh, my question also involves roofs. I've been working in an apartment complex here, doing some maintenance, cleaning the gutters out for one of them. The buildings, there's several of them, and the buildings are about 20 years old. A couple of them are a little older, a couple of them are a little not so old. They're surrounded. There's a lot of cottonwoods, over 35 or 40 mature cottonwoods, and they lose their clusters of the cottony seed and twigs and everything. So the gutters have been plugged up for years. I got up there the first time, and they were completely full. The downspouts were pretty much not even working. There's even a lot of vegetation growing them because they turned to mulch the stuff inside the gutters.
Yeah.
When I was up there, there's a lot of limbs also, large limbs hanging over the roof, which I know is a pretty bad thing. So I'm up on the roof, and I feel a lot of spongy spots. So I'd like to know, among a couple questions here, is how much damage, if any or whatever, can we tell by staying on the roof and having these, you know, very, very soft spots? And then also, because these gutters were clogged up, and also a lot of the gutters are not sloped correctly, so on the end of a 25-foot run before the downspout on the opposite end, it just naturally collects water. There's a lot of soft spots right along the edge, and some soft spots go all the way up to the peak of the roof. It's very spongy. And then the other thing is, I looked up into the attic, and the vents that are supposed to go from the soffit, and they go along the ceiling line, or the roof line, I should say, to carry that ventilation up to the peak. A lot of those, when I looked up just in my apartment, they have fallen down, and they're laying in the insulation. There's a, you know, a bunch of insulation in the floor of the attic, so I don't think they're doing their job. So I'm just wondering, like, you know, and they never have been re-roofed. So can I tell, do you think there may be a lot of damage, or you know...
Yeah.
Sounds like there's a lot of damage there. And I think you have all the answers probably too, right? I mean, you understand the gutters, and water will flow downhill if it has a hill to go down, or sometimes water can go up as well through capillary action, or if it starts getting on the roof sheathing, it can start creeping up into further up that roof system. Spongy roofs aren't a good thing, and
no.
it may be a sign of simply the gutters being in poor maintenance and poor maintained. Though it may be something further than that if the roof sheathing is pretty delaminated and looks wet from the underneath side. There may be something more going on than simply just the roofs. So that having the gutters in being poor maintained might be a sign that other things haven't been maintained well. Which leads to moisture transport from inside to that attic space, or just other flashing details that are in disrepair.
The other thing I would add is that era of building that we're talking about, from the late 70s through the 80s, we have found on many residential homes from that period that it seems we were putting the thinnest possible plywood on those roof decks, and often 24 inches on center. We've had some houses where it just seems like it's a miracle that the structure held together. You know, that in fact you may find that the house was really underbuilt, and it needs a new layer of plywood that's thicker than what you have. The sponginess may be partially a result of that slightly underbuilt building.
Well, so. If I may add one more thing, there's also another thing that you can see from the ground is each building has 12 units in it, so they have these beams or something that go through every once in a while. You can, and so what I'm saying is that you can look at the roof and you can see all this warpage going on, not just between what we're probably be the rafters or whatever, you know, but you know, a lot of sagging and warpage you can just visually see. Does that tell a lot too?
It may have to do with ice dams. A lot of those larger multifamily buildings and units haven't the insulation. One at the code at the time was built is less than there is now, so we have that heat loss as well as the air leakage. We have heat moving into that attic space through a number of ways, and ice built up at the eaves. So maybe you've been there over a few years, or can talk to residents that have, and let you know if there's big icicles hanging off at those areas.
Yeah, there's the ice. The gutters actually fill up completely with ice, 100%. I mean, the ice rises 2 inches above the gutters, and yes, the icicles are there.
Yeah, so you've got a pretty good problem on your hands, and it's not just one cause that often makes this all happen. Usually there's a number of things that need to be addressed to really take care of the total problem and deal with that whole structure. And it's going to take some diagnostics, which is going to look at the air leakage, air tightness, the insulation, the attic ventilation, and a good quality visual inspection by somebody who's been there before to write a detailed work scope for you.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call as well, Marcus. And some more callers online here. We had an email, though, from Nancy in La Crosse, planning to replace carpeting with a hardwood floor. Would like to use recycled wood from our local recycling center. Some has been pulled up from an old gymnasium. It's maple. Looks to be in good shape. Any concerns that she would need to have regarding using recycled wood in a floor like that?
Well, the only thing that I would be concerned about would be during the process of refinishing, and I will assume typically when you put in a hardwood floor, you will then sand the top of it and refinish it. You might want to have that the finishes tested just to make sure that you don't have toxins in there. You'd primarily potentially be dealing with lead, possibly. That would really be the only concern I can think of, and that's a concern that we always have when we're dealing with older materials.
And Ann in Greendale, she and her husband are considering using bamboo flooring in their kitchen remodeling. Like to know the different ways it can be fabricated and whether there are some forms that are more durable than others for handling heavy use in the kitchen. We also want to avoid bamboo flooring that might have been made using adhesive or materials that are unhealthy.
Well, there are a couple of different criteria out there for rating building products for their sustainability or green criteria. And it's somewhat an area that's, we always have to be somewhat skeptical about what manufacturers are telling us about their product right now, because essentially everyone is claiming that their product is green or that their process is green. And a lot of times, even as a contractor who is striving to, be well informed about these issues, we're very dependent on our suppliers for that information. We're pressing them to give us better information and better sourcing on where the product is coming from. So that's one issue, and I can't direct you to a particular website just off the top of my head. Maybe John would know.
There's a website that I've been turning to here recently called greenbuildingadvisor.com. So there are a lot of good information, good schematics and drawings. Some of the information is on a for-fee basis, but they're there and willing to answer a lot of questions. And the people that operate that website are top-notch.
I would also add it with respect to the bamboo question and the types of flooring. Bamboo is a product. It's very, it grows as basically a reed, so it's a very thin piece of wood, and it's often glued together such that you see the plies that are about an eighth to 3/16 of an inch thick glued, side by side. You can actually see that from above. There are some products that actually take that thin laminate and adhere it to a substrate so that you have a thin layer of bamboo on top of some other material. Sometimes it's a press board or plywood or some other hardwood. So there are a variety of different products out there. I tend to be more of a purist when it comes to wood floors. I think that having the solid plank or at a minimum a thick veneer on the top, say a minimum of a quarter inch, is the way to go so that that floor can be refinished and essentially have the life of it extended.
Let's turn to Sharon in Janesville now. Sharon, hi to you.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a large glassed-in porch on the back of my house, and it's a really good source of, like, solar heating. But unfortunately, all the window frames on the doors and windows out there are made of wood, and they're all going bad, and the glass is sagged down, and so it's leaking, and I'm trying to get it repaired before winter. But my question is, this is a porch, and I'm wondering if it qualifies for the energy tax credit things, or is that only for the body of the house?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that you would probably find that this is not something that's going to qualify unless, in fact, you are adding the windows to a space which you are converting to the heated space of your house. And it sounds like this is a two- or three-season porch that you just are, you know, heating or cooling with the outdoors.
Well, it has a heater in it, but it's, the heater is not part of the main furnace, but it does have heat, so you can use it pretty much year-round.
You know, I think this is probably a little bit of a gray area, and there's, you have one door, a doorway that separates the two spaces, the main living and the glass area.
Yeah, I can open my living room, and then all the living room door goes to the porch, and then all the solar heat pours in, and I can turn off my furnace.
Yeah, maybe there's a frequently asked questions on EnergyStar.gov website that would answer that question for you.
Okay.
EnergyStar.gov. All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And, here's an email from Heidi, who's in Denver, Colorado, who's been there for a year but still listens to Wisconsin Public Radio and actually contributes to Wisconsin Public Radio. She just purchased a two-level townhome-style condo in July. It's new construction in the master bath on the second floor. I hear a cracking sound coming from the floor under or near the shower stall. The sound appears only after I take a shower. It occurs when I step anywhere about 5 feet in front of the shower door and in places to the left and right of the shower. It's quite disturbing to someone who is still sleeping in the adjoining room. Apparently, it's loud enough. Any idea as to other information that might be helpful? At the entrance to the bathroom, I feel a cool spot in the summer and a hot spot in the winter on the tile floor that makes me think there is some ductwork underneath that isn't fully connected, possibly.
Yeah, that was my question. If you have forced air heating and cooling, so if you have forced air heating and cooling, and we can kind of line up the ductwork where the registers are and understand that the metal duct system, if it's metal, runs in that area. Potentially that could be maybe expanding and contracting when the furnace is on, but it sounds like it's when you step in that area and it's a nice tiled floor. So that starts steering me away from any deflection on that floor if you're stepping on a nice tile bathroom floor.
Especially if it was tiled properly with structure underneath the substructure was cement or whatever they use.
Yeah, we need to have a little bit more information. Chad, what do you got?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is still possible that there is some deflection going on that due to the potential leak in the duct. I mean, that sounds like that's part of it, that you've got a combination of material expanding and contracting and, you know, that movement combined with the added rise in moisture levels when you're taking a shower. I mean, it could all come together to explain the problem. And it is true. I mean, there are underlayments that should be used to allow that tile to withstand a little bit of deflection. There are a lot of variables here that would
probably
require.
Need to have somebody come take a look at it, I would guess.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for that email. Chad Spate, John Viner, our guests here as we talk home renovation and repair issues on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking energy efficiency, home renovation and repair issues with Chad Spate of Chad's Carpentry in Madison and John Viner of the Energy Center of Wisconsin. Jennifer in Hubertus is up next. So let's go to Jen. Hi, Jen.
Hi. My husband and I are doing a remodel of our kitchen, and we want to put hardwood flooring in. We have two layers of vinyl with asbestos in it. I had it tested, and it does have asbestos. The retail outlet that we're working with said that nailing into hardwood and then into an asbestos floor isn't good, totally understandable. I just wanted to get your opinion on, is nailing into that bad, and what is involved in asbestos removal, and if you have any idea of pricing of that.
Well, generally, you would, and you would by law have to have an asbestos abatement contractor, a certified contractor, come and remove that material.
Okay.
How big is the kitchen?
Approximately 350 feet. Mm.
350 square feet.
Yeah. I would guess that, you know, you're going to be spending a couple of $1,000s on the removal. Might be less. I mean, I always hesitate to give pricing because things are different in different areas. But, you know, you're probably going to spend about twice as much for the asbestos abatement as you would for, say, the flooring company to typically come in and just tear it out. And there, obviously, you wouldn't go that path, and they're not willing to go that way. But as far as nailing into it, I think the biggest problem you would have there is not knowing exactly how consistent that old floor is. It is possible sometimes to go over top, but then, of course, you've got a really high elevation for the floor, and you're going to have a probably a minimum of 3/4 inch with your new floor.
Right.
So I would say find a qualified asbestos abatement contractor and have that removed. And, you know, it may double the price of what the removal would have been had it not been for the asbestos, but then you can go on and the, you know, you have things done properly.
Okay.
All right.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. An email from Pete from La Crosse asking you to clarify the meaning of a U value of 0.3. He says it's the same as R3.3 as applied to windows. 0.3 or R3.3 is pretty good, but compared to an ordinary 2x4 wall with an R value of 13, the window suffers from four times as much heat loss. And then the rhetorical question is, does one really need ceiling to floor windows?
Sure. So the R value is the resistance to heat flow. It's the rating. They use the letter R to signify resistance to heat flow, and larger the number, the better. And the U value is the inverse of the R value. So you would take your R11 wall, you would take 1 divided by 11, and you would get the U value.
Mm-hmm.
It happens that 0.35... Let's see. So that is about a 3R value. So they're close in that respect, but that'll change as the values change and whether they'll be able to compare it like that from 0.3 to an R value of 3. So the lower the U value, the better.
And the higher the R value, the better.
And the higher the R value, the better. That's right.
And it's always true that a window is a big hole in the wall. I mean, I've had many clients over the years say, you know, it's really drafty in front of my windows, and we'll do a home performance evaluation and find out the windows aren't drafty. There's just a huge plate glass on the front of their house, and in the winter, cold air falls off of that because, you know, you have the heat transfer happening on that glass that isn't happening where the wall is located.
Yeah, yeah. When we got that large surface area of Florida walls, I've been in some pretty nice houses where I could see why you would want to take advantage of the views and bring the outdoors in. It's a nice architectural feature, but the discomfort that can be felt, as Chad said, isn't always because of air leakage. It's just it's the radiant heat loss from our warm bodies giving up heat to that cold surface, regardless of the air movement in and around the home.
Let's turn to Alan in Rice Lake now. Alan, hello to you.
Hello to you. One more question about metal roofs. Can you speak of the benefits or drawbacks of a metal roof? I have just a simple ranch home. And also, does the gauge of the metal make any kind of difference in the performance?
I would think the gauge would. It's certainly, they're getting to be a lot more popular, aren't they?
Yeah, metal roof is what we often refer to as a 100-year roof, just because metal, if properly maintained, can last a long time, as opposed to what has become the standard for roofing, an asphalt shingle. That is the cheapest, and it is a disposable surface. So once it wears through, there's really no way to restore it, so you tear it off, or if you have just one layer, you could choose to cover over it, but you've got to put a whole new layer. So the metal roof can be repainted or repaired. You know, there was a time when an old tin roof was popular on a porch. Now sometimes we have copper roofing. A lot of the roofing, metal roofing out there now is just a painted steel roof. So you do have different materials, and a thicker gauge is generally better. But it is a larger investment. It is, you know, more expensive to put on a metal roof, but it will last longer. So, yeah, that's pretty much what I can say.
We've had a lot of questions today, Larry, about the roof. So mm-hmm. I just want to put out a resource that I've found that is useful on the web is the National Roofing Contractors Association. They do have a national office out of Chicago. I believe the website's nrca.net.
nrca.net.
So, National Roofing Contractors Association. They do have a homeowner page and lots of frequently asked questions to browse through that I think will help some of the folks out that have been calling today.
And Karen in Portage, by the way, may have a roofing question as well. Karen, hi.
Hi. First background, I have some fiberglass corrugated sheets that are 40 years old. They've been recycled around the farm 50 times. They're still usable. I have some 10-year-old, which is thinner, but it's been recycled and holding. Now,
and where is this?
On a farm.
I mean, but where are you using the plastic?
On the roof mainly. I take it off and, you know, upgrade to something else and move it around. And it hangs in there for 40 years. Now, I did an arbor, and I bought a plastic product from a big box retailer that was supposed to be so great. The corrugated melted out of it by the time I got it up, and it's as brittle as eggshells to walk on. So now we have new products. We have Polycarb, which is about $23 a sheet. I love this stuff. I've got it 6 years. It's like glass for looking through, but it's pricey. So I went to get some fiberglass. The lumber yard said they didn't carry it anymore because they couldn't even keep it in stock. That storing it, the corners were breaking off. So they went to a PVC, which is a bluish color, and it's very flexible when you put it up. It fastens fine, but now I had a sheet lying supported on a dog trot, 12-inch by 12-inch squares on 2x4s, not even nailed down. A branch came down, hit it, and shattered it. I called him and said, I'm not buying that stuff anymore. There has to be a different grade of fiberglass out there, something. Do you have information on the fiberglass sheetings that are manufactured today?
Information on the fiberglass sheeting.
This is just for like you said, an arbor or a porch mm-hmm. area where yeah. we're using the corrugated fiberglass sheeting that it's kind of diffusive where the light goes through. And mm-hmm. I don't have any particular hands-on experience with that or where we might go. I can see it. Certainly, it does get brittle. Karen, the product that you've used over the years, and that was a fiberglass kind of translucent panel?
The newer one is more translucent. The older one is opaque. But like I said, you know, 40-year-old fiberglass, and it's still bouncing around. And they said they can't keep, they won't order the fiberglass sheetings anymore because they're breaking on the shelf.
Yeah.
And I can't believe that for fiberglass. And I said, well, maybe it's a very thin, low price range, low grade fiberglass. Investigate a higher grade.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can't afford to do this polycarbonate at $23 a sheet, even though it's a beautiful product.
Yeah.
But this PVC, which is supposed to be warranted for 15 years, I said, you know, it, they can't say that it was my fault because of your improper fastening or whatever.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I just went online and looked at fiberglass materials ratings online, and I'm not seeing a lot here, but there is a Forbes aired book that you might want to refer to. You could probably go online and find that and take a look at it and see if you could find some more information out. But it may be that there's a real direct relationship between price and quality on this one.
Karen? Yeah, it might be at today's prices where you bought that quality one that's held up over the years, and you find out what the price might be.
Yeah.
It's going to be at that $20-some a sheet.
Chad Spate and John Viner, our guests here on the Ideas Network. Talking energy efficiency, home renovation, and repair issues today with Chad Spate of Chad's Carpentry in Madison and John Viner of the Energy Center of Wisconsin, and joined as well by Chad Krieger of Digger's Hotline to talk with us a little bit about what Digger's Hotline does and how it fits into your potential plans. I know we have had a question about somebody wanting to install a drainage system in their yard, and if you're going to be installing something like that, Chad Krieger, you with us?
Yes, I am.
You're going to be installing something like a sewer pipe in your yard, you better be calling Digger's Hotline, I would guess.
Absolutely. Anytime you're using a shovel or anything more, you know, powerful than that, you definitely want to be calling Digger's Hotline. There's all kinds of utility lines underneath the ground. You may not know where they are. They may be more shallow than what you think. That's why the state law says anytime you're disturbing the soil, you have to call Digger's Hotline so you can find out where those buried lines are.
And if you neglect to call Digger's Hotline and you do hit the water line or the power line or whatever, aside from you hit the power line, electrocuting yourself maybe, you're looking at, as a homeowner, repairing, making those, paying for the repairs yourself, are you not?
You're correct. You touched on both bad sides to not calling. One, it's dangerous. You could electrocute yourself, like you said. If you're cutting into a natural gas line, you know, that can escape and that can ignite, that can take out a neighborhood. That's part of it, is the danger. The other part of it is the cost. No matter what you hit, you're going to have to pay for someone to come out, the utility to come out and get that repaired. If you call Digger's Hotline and, you know, that's how you know where those lines are, so you're not hitting them, so you don't have to pay to have it repaired.
And there's not a cost associated with this, is my understanding.
That's correct. It's a free call. It's a free service. We're a nonprofit that's just trying to make sure people are doing things safe in the right way.
So, and is there an 800 number that is generally available, or does the depending on where you are in the state, does that vary?
No, there's a few ways to contact us. We have an 800 number, and that's 800-242-8511. But there's also something new. It's a three-digit dialing code. It's 811. Works a lot like 911, except it connects you to Digger's Hotline. Now, with the 811, you have to be in Wisconsin to use it. If you're in Minnesota, it's not going to work. That's kind of a location-based service. So that's 811. You can also do this online at our website, diggershotline.com.
And I can imagine, I know of I haven't had the problem myself, but I know someone who called but then didn't want to wait, so they just went ahead, and the first thing they did was break the water line, and I think a power line or electric line as well.
Yeah,
and that was a big mess.
When you jump the gun, when you call, you have to wait 3 business days to have the utilities come out and mark where those lines are. And a business day, it's not going to count a weekend. It's not going to count a state legal holiday, like Veterans Day, for example. So if you call Digger's Hotline and you don't wait those 3 days, it's almost like not calling at all, because the reason you call is to get the utilities to come up and mark those lines. If you're not going to wait for them, there's not a lot of point in calling in the first place.
And so they find the location, and then you should and they're marked, aren't they, with paint marks, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, they're going to use paint, or they got these little plastic flags they'll stick in the ground, and they use different colors based on what the type of line is, electric or natural gas or water or cable TV, et cetera. So they're going to mark it, and that it's kind of an approximation, though, of where that line is beneath the ground. That's why if you're going to dig within 18 inches of that mark on the ground, you have to use a shovel or an other hand tool and dig carefully. You can't just let it go with a big backhoe right next to one of those marks.
Okay, so 18 inches on either side.
That's correct.
It's a free service, Chad, and I really appreciate, Chad, you talking with us about it today. So Digger's Hotline, it's 811. That's one number to call.
The other number is 800-242-8511, or you can do it on our website, diggershotline.com.
All right. Chad, thanks a bunch.
Hey, no problem. Thank you.
I appreciate it very much. All right, there you have it. If you're going to be digging in your lawn or in the area, you better call Digger's Hotline. It's free. So why not? Plan ahead. You're going to have to wait 3 business days, but I know some people who wish they had waited the 3 business days. Catherine in Reedsburg, on to you. Hi, Catherine.
How are you? The reason I'm calling is we need to install replacement windows, and we've been looking at some of the options, and one that we're interested in are fiberglass windows. I know that one of the makers of these windows has been doing it for about 10 years maybe, but I don't really know too much about the reputation because I haven't seen many people that have them. I know they're more expensive, but I'm just wondering if they have any problems with them that are maybe different.
Well, I can speak to that. Fiberglass is increasingly an excellent high-end exterior surface. It is very common, for example, now to put in fiberglass exterior doors. That would be the typical high-end door because it has the look of wood. It does not conduct the cold or the heat the way other materials do. And it's very resilient. And then lastly, it can be painted, so you're not stuck with the color of, say, a vinyl or plastic coating. And unlike, say, a metal cladding, it won't dent. So fiberglass is generally a very good material. But, of course, like any material, it comes in different grades and qualities, and my experience has been with just one particular manufacturer as a contractor. To speak to the particular quality of a certain brand or a certain window company, that I wouldn't really be able to do. But fiberglass generally is an excellent material for the exterior.
All right.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks, Catherine, for calling. Appreciate it. And an email from Pat in Middleton actually had attached a photo to show a problem area of the home, and it has to do with ice dams that occur at the corners of the dormer of his home. And he increased the soffit ventilation, didn't do much, though. And so he's wondering, I don't know how much insulation is in the triangular-shaped areas along our house, and wondering if roof vents over the two areas that he identified would be of any help, or does he need someone to cut through the plaster walls that he has in there to inspect and maybe add insulation?
Yeah, you're going to need access into those knee wall areas. These are, we have on either side of that dormer, we have knee walls and hidden attic areas that we don't know what's behind there as far as the insulation is concerned, and adding more roof vents can simply aggravate the heat loss from those areas up and out that new roof vent that you installed. So it can aggravate and not help just by adding the roof vents, so we need to know for sure. That's a perfect time for a building performance consultant to come in and provide a little bit more analysis, write up a work scope, and kind of guide the direction of the work that's going to be done. And then he comes back to re-inspect before you cut a hole in the plaster, do the work, have the contractor come in according to the building performance consultant's recommendations before it's replastered, get that building performance consultant to come in and look at the not only the insulation, but more importantly, is the air tightness and are the holes plugged, and then did he insulate it well? And then thirdly is comes that attic ventilation. So we don't want to jump to ventilation of those attic spaces first. First is air sealing, insulating, then ventilating. That's going to be the best strategy to know the steps to take.
Denise in Waukesha has a house that's about 100 years old. The walls are still the original plaster. They've developed some cracks due to settling. Wonders if they should be concerned with asbestos in the plaster. Should we decide to take out the plaster and put up more insulation and drywall? Is there a way to test the plaster for asbestos?
Well, you're going to have to take a chunk of the material into the testing facility, and in Madison here, you would take it into the to the state lab. And I'm
not
blanking.
Sure about Waukesha.
Yeah, I'm not sure there, but I imagine you could contact the state or go onto the website and be able to get that information. There are places where you can take it, and generally, it's going to cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 to $50 for that sample to be tested. That's what the state hygiene lab charges here in the Madison area. I will note that there are some changes in the laws that are in the process of being implemented. And while homeowners are, as far as I understand it, still able to test... you're able to test the materials in your home and even sometimes to remove those materials without having the proper certification for doing it safely. Any building contractor is going to need to make sure that those materials are free of lead and asbestos. And if it is removed or disturbed, it will have to be done in a lead safe or in a safe manner. There's a process of certification underway right now, and the entire industry is in the process of adjusting. State regulators are still drafting the rules and the codes, and all I can tell you is that change is coming, and it will make remodeling safer for the consumer and for those of us involved in the profession. But it's something that we're really just starting to get serious about as an industry.
Jessica in River Falls, we turn to you next. Hi, Jessica.
Hello. I have a 30-year-old story-and-a-half house that my husband and I built, designed and built. And then 5 years after we built the house, we built an addition on that house. About 5 years ago, I noticed that at the juncture of where the addition was built onto the house, the siding was soft, so my son and I, my husband passed away, so my son and I took off that siding in that area and found that it must have been leaking for quite some time because it was rotted down to the, the exterior board, the plywood. And so we redid it and put it back together again. But I'm seeing that the two of the masonite pieces of siding is once again beginning to disintegrate. So my question is, what is the correct way to put an addition onto the house so that you don't have this occurring?
What can you tell me about the way the roof attaches, the roof on the addition? How does that attach to your original home?
Is there a flashing?
Put it right up to it.
Okay,
right.
And do they have a common roof, or is...
No, it does not. It butts up to the side of the house.
So is there siding on the old house above the new roof?
Yes.
Okay. That is a likely place that... It could be that that it's not a major leak, but that every time or during certain sorts of storms that water is getting in at that flashing point.
Right.
And slowly but surely, it's rotting the wall behind it there. And that would, at the junction point, would be the logical place to see that, not, you know, knowing exactly how it's all put together. But generally with the rotting like that, you know, you generally would look above and try to figure out where might water be getting into the structure above this particular spot.
Well, I'm pretty sure that the water is entering, the water is entering right at the end of the roof line of the addition.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately what happened is, you know how you put the siding, the pieces of siding on? Well, the siding, the one of the boards is right in level with the roof line.
Mm-hmm.
So when the, as the water flows off that roof, it, I'm thinking it's following that one board, and it just, and so I suppose what you can do is take an odd size board and make that line so that it doesn't meet that roof line.
Well, I may not be following exactly what your circumstance is, but what is typically the case is that there's step flashing that goes along the roof, and it basically keeps water from getting behind the roof or into the wall where the roof meets the wall above it. And at the very bottom of that, where you're having the problem, it's very important that there be a piece of flashing that kicks the water out of the wall and out beyond the exterior of the building. And it's actually a detail that is missing on many buildings. What happens is the step flashing goes all the way down and the water runs down this little canal and then it gets to where the roof ends and nothing kicks it out of the structure and water slowly collects in the exterior wall below. So it's a typical problem. It's something that a roofing contractor could probably fix for you, and or building contractor, possibly a handyman, if you know, you or your son aren't able to take care of it. That's probably the cause.
All right.
Okay. That does make sense to me. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Dave in Harshaw says, when removing screens from my windows today, I noticed a white, fuzzy, mold-like substance on the bottom of the window frame right up next to the glass. Frames are pine fir, home 15 years old, windows are original. In the 7 years I've lived here, I have never seen this before on any of my windows. What might be the cause there? What do you think, John?
So it's a white mold or white fuzzy substance on the sill.
Probably a mold of some sort.
Yep. And it could be just something really simple and an indication maybe there's not a serious concern or a problem there. For some reason, we've had just a little bit of moisture staying in that place, maybe some wind-driven rain. Hard to tell for sure. Simply, if we're going to clean it up, we can clean it up with a mild soap and water detergent and watch the indoor humidity levels, watch any opportunities for wind-driven rain to go in there and just try to prevent it. But I would say simply just clean it up with a mild soap detergent and try to prevent it from getting wet again. We can't say that there's anything serious wrong with that. In Wisconsin, in a cold climate and the weather that we have, we all get a little bit of mold or fuzzy stuff growing in a few corners in our windows. We clean it up and do the best we can to manage the moisture.
Let's turn to Judy in Reedstown. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I'd like to back up the woman who is extolling the virtues of old fiberglass. I used old fiberglass, too. They were once long sheets for, you know, one of those folding garage doors, and I turned them the other way and used them as a shed roof on a building, and they lasted and lasted and lasted, and they didn't leak, and I'm just wondering whether maybe part one component of our inflation is really not just the rise in prices, but the decrease in quality of some of the materials that we're asked to buy. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I wanted to say was I'd like to ask for more clarity with your Digger's Hotline. I live on a farm, and there have been lines put in, not by the major utilities, but by private electricians, and Digger's Hotline doesn't identify those lines. So you could still be digging into a time bomb even after Digger's Hotline has made the utilities, the public utilities, come out and flag your yard.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent point, Judy. It is true that lines that are on the property that the homeowner has put in, often from an outbuilding to the house, are the private, you know, they are a private line, and it is the responsibility of the homeowner to essentially know where those lines are and to avoid them. You're right. Those lines will not be marked by Digger's Hotline.
All right. That's a good point. Thank you very much, Judy, for calling. Appreciate your call. And Lloyd in La Crosse, on to you. Hi, Lloyd.
Hello. I have a question in regards to we have an older home with oak flooring, and the floors squeak in regards to the traffic areas. I was wondering if there's anything that can be done to
get rid of that squeak in the floor, oak flooring. Chad?
Well, it's sometimes there are some things that can be done. It is a little bit of a inexact science because squeaking in old floors is caused by a couple of things. One thing that is most commonly causing it is just you have a loose board and it's rubbing against the nails that are in the old floor, and that squeaking sound is just the friction between the nail and the board. And then sometimes it's exacerbated by not having tar paper or proper underlayment in between the subfloor and the hardwood floor. So it is possible sometimes if we have access from below, we can put some screws in to pull together parts of the flooring that are loose and the cause of a lot of the squeaking. It's a careful process, but it's one that is sometimes successful in at least minimizing squeaks. And then sometimes we can inject some adhesives into areas where we have cavities that it would not be practical to pull it all tight. But if we can get an adhesive in there that will harden and solidify, that will take care of it as well. So it's a tough thing to really address, but there are some
ways
solutions.
That can be done. Okay. And on that note, we have to close. Chad, John, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it. And Chad, your website, you have a website, right?
Yes, it's www.chadscarpentry.com.
Chadscarpentry.com. And, of course, you mentioned, John, earlier, your website, which pretty easy one.
Yep. ECW.org.
ECW.org or O-R-G. Well, look forward to your next visit, guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Yeah, thanks, Larry.
Lots of time on roofs today.
Yeah.
A lot of roof issues. But tell you what, the guys did a good job, and we'll have them back, and we'll talk with them once again. ChadsCarpentry.com, the one website, the other, ECW.org. Just taking a look ahead tomorrow, hey, it's Friday. That means Garden Talk. And Dane County UW Extension horticulture educator Lisa Johnson will be joining us. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.